Good evening, and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm Heather Brown. Tonight, we launch Writing Quebec, a 10-part series of readings of remarkable Quebec literature. Inspired by the final selection of Canada Reads, Hubert Aquin's next episode, Between the Covers decided to celebrate Quebec fiction and poetry. There will be readings from authors you may know well, and others you may be encountering for the first time. Writing Quebec is the title of a collection of essays by Hubert Aquin. For this series, we have focused on post-war writing from 1945 onwards. It's a period that covers Quebec literature from the Duplessis era to the Quiet Revolution, the struggles for independence, and the election of the Parti Québécois to the most recent referendum. Tonight's selection is by Anne Hébert, a poet, playwright, and novelist. Anne Hébert is one of Quebec's greatest writers. Born in 1916, she lived in Paris for most of her writing life. However, Quebec remained her source of inspiration. She died in 2000. Hébert was honored with numerous Canadian and international awards. Her best-known novels are Kamouraska, The Silent Rooms, and The First Garden. And as recently as 1999, her novel, Am I Disturbing You?, was shortlisted for a Giller Prize. The reading tonight comes from The Torrent, a novella written in 1945 and included later in a collection of short stories by the same name. The Torrent is a landmark work in Quebec literature. In it, the narrator, François, reveals the deep roots of his rebellion against his domineering mother. She is determined to sacrifice him to God as restitution for her past sins. Here is Brent Carver reading from The Torrent by Anne Hébert, translated by Gwendolyn Moore.
As a child, I was dispossessed of the world. By the decree of a will higher than my own, I had to renounce all possession in this life. I related to the world by fragments, only at those points which were immediately and strictly necessary, and which were removed from me as soon as their usefulness had ended. I was permitted the scribblers which I had to open, but not the table on which they lay, the corner of the stable which I was to clean, but not the hen perching on the window sill, and never, never the countryside which beckoned through the window. I could see the large hand of my mother when it was raised towards me, but I could not perceive my mother as a whole, from head to foot. I could only feel her terrible size, which chilled me. I had no childhood. I cannot recall any time that was my own. My mother worked incessantly, and I participated in this work with her, like a tool in her hands. She rose with the sun, and the succeeding hours of her day dovetailed with an exactitude which left no possibility of digression. Other than the lessons which she gave me until I entered secondary school, she never talked to me. She was uncommunicative by nature. For her to depart from this rule, I had to commit a sin. That is to say, she only spoke to me in reprimand before punishing me. As concerns my studies, there again, everything was planned, calculated, with never a day's holiday and never a vacation. When she had finished a lesson, her countenance became that of a total mute, her lips tightly sealed, as if closed by a bolt from inside. As for me, I would lower my eyes, relieved that I no longer had to follow the working of her powerful jaws and her thin lips as she pronounced each syllable of the words, chastisement, God's justice, damnation, discipline, hell, original sin, and above all that distinctive phrase which recurred like a leitmotif, one must master oneself utterly. We have no idea of the evil forces within us. Do you hear me, François? I will master you myself. And at this I would begin to shiver, and tears would fill my eyes, for I knew what would come next. François, look me in the eyes. And then the long, drawn-out punishment would begin. We were always alone. Although I was almost 12 years of age, I had not yet looked upon another human face, except for my own shimmering reflection when I leaned over the stream to drink. As for my mother, only the lower part of her face was familiar to me. I did not dare raise my eyes up to the angry pupils and the broad forehead, her bodice black and armored, with no tender place in which the head of a child might nestle. Such was the maternal universe in which, so young, I learned hardness and rejection. We lived too far from the village even to go to Mass, but that did not prevent my passing almost the whole of a Sunday on my knees at times in punishment for some misdeed. This was, I believe, the maternal fashion of sanctifying the Lord's Day at my expense. I had never seen my mother pray, but I had suspected that she did sometimes when closeted in her room. At that time, I was so dependent on my mother that the least stirring within her had repercussions inside me. Oh, I did not really understand anything of the drama of this woman, but I sensed, as one senses a storm, the most subtle changes in her moods. And on the evenings when I believed my mother to be praying, I did not dare move on my straw pallet. The silence was as heavy as death. I awaited some unknown tempest which would sweep us both away, we who were so bound together in a common and somber destiny. One desire grew within me daily and weighed upon me like nostalgia: to see another human face, close up and in detail. I tried to scrutinize my mother stealthily, but almost always she turned abruptly towards me, and I would lose heart. I resolved to go and find the face of a man, not daring to hope for that of a child, and promising myself to flee if it were that of a woman. And to this end, I decided to post myself by the side of the main road. In time, someone would surely pass by. Our house stood remote from any line of communication, in the center of a stretch of woods and fields, and water in all its moods, from the calm of the stream to the rush of the torrent. I went through the maple grove and across the great stony fields which my mother persisted in plowing, her teeth clenched, her hands gripping the handles, the shocks at times causing her to lose her hold. Our old horse, Alois, had died of this work. After crossing the burned-over clearing where my mother and I picked blueberries every summer, I found myself by the road. Out of breath, I stopped short, as though a hand had touched my forehead. And I wanted to cry, for the road was bare and forlorn in the sunlight. Unvarying, soulless, dead. Where were the processions I had imagined I would discover? Over this ground had passed feet other than my mother's or my own. Where were those footsteps now? In what direction had they gone? They had not left a mark. Surely the road must have died. Not daring to walk on it, I followed the ditch. Suddenly I stumbled over a form stretched out in the deep grass and fell headlong in the mud. I got up, dismayed at my dirty clothes, and I saw a horrible man beside me. He must have been sleeping, for he was now slowly sitting up. Glued to the spot, I was unable to move, expecting to be killed at the least. I did not even have the strength to hide my face with my arm. The man was filthy. Dried and fresh mud by turns covered his clothing and his face. His long hair mingled with his beard, his mustache and his eyebrows, which were so heavy they hung over his eyes. My God! What a face! Full of bristling hair and spatters of mud. I saw the gummy mouth with its yellow teeth. I wanted to run away, but he seized me by the arm, taking hold of me as he tried to get up. He made me fall head over heels. He laughed, and his laugh was as beastly as he was, matching him perfectly. Once more I tried to escape, but he made me sit down on the edge of the ditch beside him. His foul odor mingled with the smell of the swamp. Under my breath, I muttered an act of contrition and thought of God's judgment, which I believed would follow upon the terror and disgust which this man inspired in me. He kept his coarse and dirty hand on my shoulder. "How old are you, Sonny?" Without waiting for my reply, he added, "Do you know any stories? No? Eh? Well, I know some." And he put his arm around my shoulders. I tried to squirm away, but he tightened his grip, laughing. His laughter spewed out close to my cheek. And at that moment, I saw my mother in front of us. She had in her hand the large stick which she used to bring in the cows. And for the first time, I saw her in her entirety. Tall, strong, a clear image and more powerful than I had ever believed her to be. "Let that child go." The man got to his feet with difficulty, surprised and as much fascinated by my mother as I was. My mother addressed me in the tone one uses for a dog, shouting, "Go home, Francois." Slowly, my legs giving way beneath me, I started down the path towards the clearing. The man was talking to my mother. He seemed to know her. In his drawling voice, he was saying,
"Well, if it isn't beautiful, Claudine. And to find you here."
"So you left the village because of the youngster, eh?"
"Fine little boy. Yes, very fine. But to find you here?"
"Everybody thought you were dead."
"Get out of here," thundered my mother.
"Big Claudine."
"Not over shy in those days. Don't be mad." "I forbid you to be familiar with me, you pig."
And then I heard the dry crack of a blow, followed by the dull thud of something falling. I turned around. My mother was standing there at the edge of the woods, immense, the cudgel shaking in her hand. The man was stretched out at her feet. She must have used the heavy end of the stick to hit him on the head. Big Claudine. I called her this mentally from then on. Assured herself that the man was still alive, gathered up her skirts, jumped over the ditch, and set off again on the path towards our house. I preceded her, running. The echoes of my flight resounded in my ears, together with the sound of my mother's robust stride behind me. She caught up with me by the house and entered the kitchen, dragging me by the arm. She had thrown the stick away. I was frightened and aching all over. And nevertheless, I felt an inexplicable curiosity and attraction. I understood obscurely that what was to follow would be as awesome as what had just happened. My senses, dulled by a life of monotony and confinement, were awakening. I was living through an impressive and terrifying adventure. My mother said in a cutting voice, "A human being is a beautiful thing, eh, Francois? You should be happy now that you've seen one close up, face to face. Attractive, isn't it?" Shattered to realize that my mother had divined my inmost secret, I raised my eyes to her, having lost all self-control. The conversation went on with my wild eyes held by hers. I was paralyzed, magnetized by big
Claudine. The world is not beautiful, Francois. You must not touch it. Renounce it right now. Freely. Don't lag behind. Do as you're told without looking around you. You are my son, and you are the continuation of me. You will fight against your evil instincts until you achieve perfection. Fire shot from her eyes. Standing in the middle of the room, her whole being erect, she expressed the violence she could no longer contain. I was transfixed with fear and admiration. And then her voice softening a little, as though talking to herself, she kept repeating,
"Self-possession, self-mastery. Above all, never give in to oneself."
And my mother stopped. Her long hands were already calm. And from them, calm spread through her. Her expression was withdrawn. And only her eyes retained a spark like the remnants of a feast in a deserted house. Francois, I will go back to the village with my head high. Everyone will bow to me, and it will be my victory. My victory. I'll never let a dirty drunk slobber over me or touch my son, Francois. You are my son. You will overcome your evil instincts and attain perfection. You will become a priest. You will be respected. Respect. What a victory over all of them. A priest. The idea crushed me. Above all this day when I'd been so hurt in my search for a kind face. My mother had often explained to me, the Mass is the sacrifice. The priest is both the sacrificer and the victim. Like Christ, he has to immolate himself upon the altar mercilessly with the host. I was so young, and I had never been happy. I broke into sobs. My mother almost threw herself upon me, and then she turned on her heel, saying in her curt voice, "Crybaby, weakling, I have received a reply from the principal. You will go to the college on September 4th, next Thursday. Go and get an armful of kindling so I can light the stove for supper. Go on. Move." When this eventful day had passed, I forced myself to erase it from my mind upon the orders of my mother. Molded for so long by her iron rule, I succeeded well enough in rejecting any conscious memory of those scenes, and in accomplishing mechanically the work imposed on me. Deep within me, however, I experienced at times an unwonted, an inexpressible richness whose slumbering presence astonished and troubled me. The practical effect, if one could call it that, of my first encounter with the world was to put me on my guard, and to lock up within me any spontaneous gesture of human sympathy I might naturally have had. My mother had scored a victory.
That was Brent Carver reading from The Torrent by Anne Hébert, translated by Gwendolyn Moore. It was originally published by Harvest House. Our series returns tomorrow with a reading from Dust Over the City by André Langevin. We're also featuring poetry by Anne Hébert over the next 4 nights in both French and English. So join us for more of Writing Quebec. Right now, stay tuned for the CBC Radio 1 News, followed by late night music from Winnipeg on Northern Lights.